This podcast is brought to you by the School of Security Studies at King's College London. Welcome to the War Studies podcast with me, Sam Martin. Gangs are a global phenomenon, from Rio to Cape Town to London, and tend to be the subject of public fear and government crackdown. In this edition, we speak to two researchers whose first-hand studies of gangs challenge many popular assumptions and mainstream policy approaches to this phenomenon. Later, Kieran Mitten of King's College London will give a broad view of gangs as a field of study. But first is an interview with Dennis Rogers, of the Geneva Graduate Institute, whose research actually led him to join a gang in Nicaragua in the 1990s. He starts by explaining how this came about.
I didn't actually start off with the idea of studying gangs. In fact, let's put it this way. I think, had I known in advance that I would end up studying gangs, I might not have actually gone to Nicaragua in the first place. I mean, I went to Nicaragua for the first time in 1996 as a PhD student, and I had a project which was about the relationship between political conviction and the survival strategies of the urban poor. And effectively, I was very romantic and looking for revolution. I mean, although I arrived 6 years after the end of the revolution, the Sandinista revolution had been a very important kind of factor in the development of my political consciousness as a teenager. And so I wanted to kind of get the sense of the place and the people and the kind of process that had been so important in my life and how it had changed people for the better. My PhD project was actually had the very grand title of Songs of Life and Hope. Within 3 days in Nicaragua, I had renamed it Chants of Apathy and Nihilism. And I had also been attacked and beaten up by a gang because I was wandering around the streets on foot, not knowing what I was doing. It's a bit of a habit that I unfortunately acquired for the next couple of months as I would go to poor neighborhoods to try and find one that I could go and live in. Basically going in on foot, trying to find local community leaders, and being an outsider going into a neighborhood was maybe a prime target for gangs. I learned relatively quickly what was the best amount to have on me to kind of not be beaten too hard and not to frustrate them too much about not having anything. And when I finally managed to move into a poor neighborhood, a bit serendipitously, it was a neighborhood which had a gang with a very nasty reputation. So, to put it mildly, I was shitting bricks. I moved in with this family, and I spent the first 3 days basically interviewing everybody there in the household multiple times, not daring to leave the house. And then after 3 days, I finally thought I'd better go and do what an ethnographer does. And so I went outside and I sat on the sidewalk smoking cigarettes kind of rather nervously and would say hello to anybody who went past to try and strike a conversation. Of course, nobody had a conversation with me, but a couple of young guys came up and sat next to me and asked me, "Who are you?" and started talking to me. Now, I didn't know this, but it was gang members, of course, because I was occupying their space, the street. Now, what I didn't know is that they weren't going to touch me because they knew that I lived in the neighborhood. At that point, the gang had this ethos of protecting the neighborhood. It was a self-protection gang. They denied being gang members, of course. When I would ask them, "Are you gang members?" Although members of the household confirmed to me, "Yeah, they're gang members." But after about a week or so of this kind of interaction, they were constantly asking me, "Are you a gang member?" And, you know, partly because, well, I was quite young at the time, I was 23. And I had a shaved head, I had an earring, I was kind of wearing clothes pretty much like gang members were wearing in Nicaragua at the time, and I was occupying public space. After about a week's interaction, they basically admitted they were gang members and started them talking about crimes and things and so on. Clearly a lot of them, a load of bullshit, trying to test whether I would, what my reaction would be. And then a little bit after that, I was sitting with the group and we were just kind of smoking away or something. And then one guy pulled out a knife and started kind of threatening me. I kind of thinking, "What the hell? What are you going on? I mean, we've been hanging out. We're what are you threatening me all of a sudden? What have I done? And he kind of just, you know, basically he was suddenly, get up. So I kind of had to get up, and everybody circled around us, and he kind of had a knife, and it's clear that this was a bit of a test. I was incredibly lucky because I have no martial training. I'm not particularly kind of strong, and I have absolutely no skill at fighting, even if I did, as a teenager, fence for a number of years. But that I can tell you is pretty useless in those circumstances. The piece of luck I had is that he was using a Swiss Army knife. Now, not one of the small ones, but one of the bigger ones, which are given to Swiss infantrymen for hand-to-hand combat. Now, I had told everybody I came from Switzerland, and I said, hey, that knife comes from where I come from. It's a Swiss Army knife. And they said, oh, yeah, it is a Swiss Army knife. And I said, give it to me, and I'll show you some things that you have no idea how to do. And so the other gang members egged him on, said, hey, give him the knife, he'll show you something. So he gave me the knife. So I went, ha, I've got the knife. At which point he kind of said, yeah, fine, okay, show us what you can do. And I basically cut my fingers up because I'm not that skilled with a Swiss Army knife, even if I have been playing around with them since I was a kid. But I had defused the situation, because actually the test was I had to stand my ground and get the knife. Now, the standard test would have been doing so through, physical violence. But by blustering my way, I also kind of passed through the test. So that was kind of the first thing to happen. A few days later, some of the guys were kind of waiting outside the place I was living in and waiting for me in the morning, quite obviously, until I kind of say, hey, what's up? And they go, hey, should we get to the market? And I thought, very excited, because this is the first time that somebody from the neighborhood had said, let's go outside the neighborhood. So off we go. And I say, so what are we up to? And they go, well, we're going to steal something. And you're going to help us. I go, wait a minute. You may have not noticed, I'm foreign. I wasn't an anthropologist. Ethically, I'm not sure I can do this. And they kind of said, well, we've thought about this. You're not going to have to actively take part. You're going to be the decoy. It's okay. I thought, okay, fine. Let's do this because, one way or another, they're going to do it. And I just thought that, if I was just going to be a decoy, it might kind of lead to less violence or whatever. So I went up to a stall, and the person with the stall came up to me, and then the guys came and ran along past and nicked some things, and I had to meet them up in the neighborhood afterwards. And then they said, okay, so now you're going to sell what we've stolen for us. So now this is where gang members have a sense of humor, because they had stolen 8 pair of women's underwear. So I basically spent the next hour and a half accosting passing women in the neighborhood saying, do you want some underwear? And sold them all. But so that was one thing. After that, they said, okay, you're now one of us, you've proven it. You're willing to kind of do things with us and so on. And I kind of said, that's great, but I'd like to have an observer member status. And that led to a third test, which was needed. And they could accept me being an observer member, because I said, I'm not going to go and attack people. I'm not going to take part in robberies. And I don't want to use firearms and this kind of stuff. But I had to show that I was willing to defend the neighborhood. And so when about a week later, a rival gang attacked the neighborhood, I had to kind of show that I was willing to kind of go up against them, to fight against them, throw stones, kind of fight with sticks. But also then afterwards, as the process of escalation occurred, go up against firearms with sticks and stones and so on. I had to basically show that I was willing to put myself at risk to protect the neighborhood. And that's, in some ways, what the whole logic of the gang at the time was. It was about protecting the neighborhood and building up a reputation. Mm-hmm. Now, this is why they wanted me to join. Because the gang had a very kind of nasty reputation, as I said, partly because there was somebody who'd killed several people, or other people were known to be very vicious, and so on. But a gang's reputation wasn't just due to violent things. And my gang became the only gang in Managua to have a foreign gang member, which gave them a lot of kudos, and but also made me a target, but that's another story.
Ethically, were there any challenges presented by this? And did you have was there any kind of institution you were part of that were overseeing this, or was it a bit self-guided?
Let's put it this way. In some ways, my thesis was done in in the days before ethic boards and ethical procedures. I mean, William Foote White, in his book Street Corner Society, basically says that, you know, ethics are effectively situational. In the case of Nicaragua, I was basically going along with things. I had experienced levels of violence that I had never experienced before. They were quite traumatic in many ways. And I was just doing what I could to kind of survive. I won't at all say that this didn't present me with an incredible research opportunity, which I grasped fully. The ultimate measure of ethics in those circumstances, according to White, is, you know, the ethnographer has to continue living with him or herself. They will engage in a series of acts. Now, if the acts that you engage in make you too uncomfortable or kind of you feel are unethical, then you probably have crossed the line. I don't believe I've crossed the line. I mean, I did things I did not want to engage in. The violence I engaged in was self-defense. I did not attack people. I did not use guns. Partly, mainly because I had no idea how to use guns, but also I just felt that would increase the chance of killing somebody. I did not engage in robbery, and so on. Now, some people think that just associating with people who do all those things is unethical, but I see this as on a scale. You know, I mean, we live in a world where, I mean, is a gangster less ethical than a fat cat banker? And it's very easy when you're out of the context to kind of set the ethical boundaries, but these become very kind of fluid and difficult to establish. And the bottom line is, I think I've done ethical research. Whether others agree with me or not is a question.
And how do you leave? Was there any issues with leaving the gang?
No, because actually in Nicaragua, there's a saying in Nicaragua, no hay viejo pandillero, there are no old gang members. It was quite natural to leave. I was already a bit older than a couple of years older than the oldest gang members. And it was normal to leave around 20, 21, 22, 23, for reasons like, you know, getting a job or founding a family and starting to feel the need to be responsible. The responsible male is all very macho. Sometimes it was due to trauma. One gang member had his best friend killed in front of him. That basically he left after that. Another person, actually his mother got killed in crossfire, partly due to his fault, and that caused him to kind of want to leave. So there was no issue about leaving. The thing which I hadn't expected, of course, at all, is because you go to do a PhD, you don't know how you'll get back or when or whatever, and it kind of has turned out that I've then developed this longitudinal research going back regularly every kind of couple of years since the original foundational research. And having joined the gang in the first time round has given me a lot of kudos and opened up lots of doors for the fact that when the gang members change from being a self-defense gang to becoming a drug dealing gang, you know, it was actually the generation just under me from the 90s, kids I'd known when they were 14, 15, 16, who were becoming the drug dealers, who trusted me, were happy to do interviews, share information, and so on. And then each new generation, of course, knows about me, partly because I am regularly in the neighborhood, but there is a knowledge of the Chile Bandiero, the foreign gang member. It's a bit weird, sometimes you become a bit of an urban legend, but at least at a local level. But this, of course, has meant that I've had amazing access and people trust me, so they're willing to do interviews and talk and help in my ongoing quest to try and understand what motivates them, why do certain things happen, why do gangs evolve in certain ways.
And finally, is there a kind of core social problem or misconception that you think your research challenges?
Yeah, I mean, several, I think. One is, there's this real perception that gangs are kind of very much autonomous, isolated. You know, you have the gang, it's evil. It's attacking. And gangs always fundamentally embedded within broader social relations, broader community. Gang members have got mothers, have got partners, have got children, and so on, fathers, you know. And this means that, you know, you can't tackle a gang just in isolation. You've got to look at it within its kind of context. And what roles does it play within the context? Now, they can be very contradictory roles, but that's, like most social processes, are very contradictory. The other thing, gangs at the same time, they're epiphenomena. They kind of reflect broader social trends and processes. And Nicaragua right now is in the grips of kind of an authoritarian repression of a popular uprising. But, you know, this is a kind of final point of a kind of arc of increasing repression that has characterized Nicaragua over the past 10 years or so. And that arc of increasing repression is also mirrored at the level of the gangs. The gangs, in that sense, constitute a bellwether institution, which also allow you to see some of the broader changes at the kind of social structural level. I don't want to say they're early warning systems, but, you know, if you see gangs move in particular directions or become more violent, for example, it perhaps tells you something about the way society or gender is going, about things like rising inequality, about segregation, about exclusion, and so on. At the same time, the third thing I want to challenge is, you know, this idea that gang members are often associated with being, you know, psychopaths, fundamentally evil. I think pretty much anybody put in the wrong circumstances, so to speak, has a chance of becoming a gang member. I mean, I've seen very little in the way of systematic factors explaining gang membership, why people join or not. And but I think we all have the potential to. At the same time, it's got to be very, we have to be clear. I mean, generally it's no more than 2% of youth in any given context who join a gang. So structural factors which are often associated with gangs, you know, poverty and so on, are not explanatory. Because how do you actually explain then the 98% of youth in a poor context who don't join a gang? So I think it's also trying to problematize these very easy links which are made. And then the final thing is, I've been tracking the life trajectories of gang members from different eras and different epochs. And one of the most striking findings is that, at least in Nicaragua, in the neighborhood I work in, former gang members are often better off than non-gang members in the long term. They have developed skills which help them afterwards. So, for example, and they're not very nice skills, but for example, the unemployment rate is huge in Nicaragua, particularly for young men. And one of the kind of standard occupations is kind of to be employed casually in the construction industry. You know, so you, through contacts, you get a job on a site. Now, people who work there are not treated very well, and often if you're at the bottom of the pile, you don't get paid. But former gang members have got the nous and the physical capacities to fight, to often become the foreman, which guarantees payment to them. And so in that sense, they kind of are better off there than kind of the non-gang members. Another example, which is perhaps more kind of uplifting, is an example of a gang member whom in my writing I call Milton. Now, Milton was a gang member. He became a drug dealer. He became a drug dealer at a time when there wasn't street dealing. He basically was a kind of runner. People would text him when they wanted drugs, and he would take the drugs to them and on his bicycle and so on. He got out of drugs after about a year and was looking for some other occupation. Now, he hadn't saved money because he was kind of spending conspicuously and so on. And he took over his mother's tortilla making business. Now, tortillas in Nicaragua are generally made by one woman, gets up very early in the morning, kind of a... If you live next to a tortilla, I can tell you it's really... tortilla making is really annoying. But she will make perhaps a couple of hundred tortillas over the course of, say, 2 hours, and then take them around the neighborhood and sell them over the course of the next... up until lunchtime. Now, that means you get a cold tortilla. And nobody, as the saying goes, in Nicaragua likes a cold tortilla. Milton invented just-in-time tortilla delivery based on his drug dealing. He took the model of kind of drug dealing, organized the making of tortillas in this way, so that initially it was just him and his wife who would get the order, make the tortillas, and then deliver them fresh. Now he employs 7 women. He produces 3,000 tortillas a day, and he makes about $200 a week, which is, which, you know, the average or the median household income in Nicaragua is $150 a month. So this is a huge amount of money. It's actually, it rivalizes what he was making when he was a drug dealer. And so this is where, you know, using the skills from his time as a drug dealer to kind of apply them to a more legitimate business, it shows that, you know, not perhaps everything about a gang member or being a gang member needs to be thrown away, and that we can perhaps try and extract certain positive elements and harness those to benefit from the undoubted energy that gang members have, at least at a social level.
That fascinating interview really sparked my curiosity about the subject even further. So I sought out Kieran Mitten, based here in the Department of War Studies, for his take on some of these questions. Starting with, what is a gang?
So people don't actually agree about what a gang is. Some people will argue that it's a very specific institutionalized group, primarily of young people, street-based and involved in crime or illicit activity. Others are in the position that it's a lot more fluid than that. London is a good example of where this disagreement exists. In some of the literature, you will see the entire introduction will be devoted to questioning whether or not London actually has a gang problem. In some neighborhoods, it might just be the case that you have groups of young people who are hanging around, very loose association with each other. Maybe they have a common kind of a name, it might even be postcode based. But they don't necessarily have a clear hierarchy, they don't necessarily coordinate all their activities together. Is that a gang? Some of them argue themselves, we're just a group of young people, we make music, or, you know, maybe occasionally we fight with rival groups, but it's not a gang in the kind of style of the US, kind of Crips and Bloods and this kind of thing. Then in other neighborhoods, you have something that's at the other end where it's so organized that it looks a lot more like an organized criminal group. And is that different also to kind of a street gang? So the reality is it depends on what you want to define it as. For me, in my research, I'm less interested in really hammering that down in a rigid manner. I'm more interested just in situations where young people, usually at the margins of society or you know socially and economically and perhaps even politically marginalized, are grouped together. Usually it's illicit activity. It's certainly not a state organized thing. It's not something that's officially sanctioned. And they have a collective identity, you know, they'll have, you know, they'll share kind of, it might be tattoos or gang colors, a street name. And they will operate as a movement, as an organization to provide security or kind of economic benefits, whether that's crime or not. It's a bit messy, to be honest. And I mean, in the research I've been doing, I've been looking at, you know, London, as I say, Freetown, where they definitely look a lot more like gangs, as you might imagine them, with the red bandanas and the gang signs and thug life tattoos. But I've also been looking in Rio, in some of the favelas, where people will call them traffickers and they're affiliated to cartels. Are they gangs or are they criminal insurgencies? This is part of the debate that's ongoing.
And I mean, in your research into gangs, what are the main challenges or difficulties you've encountered?
That's a good question. One of the challenges that you might assume would be access to gangs and getting people to be honest about their situation. Funnily enough, that hasn't been a challenge. I've generally found it very easy to access gang members in the most part and get them to talk honestly, or as far as I'm concerned, as honestly as I can get them to speak at the time about their situation in their communities. There are some places, Rio being one, where access is a little bit more difficult, depending on the security situation at the time. I was able to interview gang members in Rio in a favela complex or de Mare, but not many, not as many as I was able to interview in Cape Town or Freetown, because they were very nervous about police operations at the time. It takes a lot of trust to build up trust in me, but also the mutual person who was putting us in contact, that I'm not working for the state, or that what I say isn't going to somehow, you know, count against them. So that was a bit of a challenge in Rio. But otherwise, I'd say the biggest challenge is actually trying to find practical solutions. Mm. And that's what I'm more focused on now. There's some really great academic research, particularly by criminologists, I would argue, of a more ethnographic kind, you know, really embedded, really getting to understand the day-to-day experiences of young people. But how do you take all of these findings about why people join gangs and why gang violence takes place, and actually provide the police, and medical practitioners, policymakers in particular, with answers about what should we do? Mm-hmm. And these answers have to be practical. It's all well and good telling, you know, the government in a particular region that, yeah, you need to provide more economic opportunities and jobs and improve welfare and education, but that's always true, and that's a national problem as well. Can they actually pull that off? And if that's a long-term solution, will the electorate be willing to wait and see the results of this 5 years down the line? Usually no, they want to see action. So in Cape Town now, the military is being deployed in part because the communities themselves want to see a response. Some of the members of the communities want to see troops on the street because they feel like nothing is being done. Even though in the same community, many others are aware this probably doesn't actually solve things in the long run. So a big challenge for me and for many other academics, I would argue, is to make sure that our research is relevant and helpful without dumbing it down, but to try and find ways that we can, you know, really turn a lot of the policy responses, the default security responses, into a more positive kind of response.
And are there any sort of narrower, more actionable solutions that you've come up with at all, or is that still development?
Yeah, I think we already have histories in different municipalities of more positive ways to deal with violence. I mean, you can take, for example, Medellin in Colombia. Some people call it the miracle of Medellin, that violence has dramatically reduced over previous years. Formerly an extremely violent city, it's now experiencing, you know, relative peace. And what they did there was essentially address urban disconnection of different communities, marginalized communities, and try to link them better towards, not just through physical infrastructure, but also education and welfare opportunities. And so they understood that not just a security issue, they understood that violence had social and economic and political roots. And that seems to have worked. It's always very difficult, this is another challenge, to say definitively whether this is the main reason or the only reason, or in fact any reason, why it's reduced. You can also look in other situations. Quite famously, there's been a public health approach to violence reduction. Glasgow had quite a lot of success in taking this angle. And it reframes the issue from primarily one of criminal enforcement and criminal justice response. You know, arrest people who are committing violence, put more police on the streets, extend sentences for certain crimes as a deterrent. This clearly doesn't work. It hasn't worked in almost all situations it's been tried. The public health approach reframes it as a community response, as trying to identify people who are at risk of gang violence or violence in their lives, and providing practical solutions to help them change and to help the community address kind of social norms around violence, you know, and deal with things like unemployment and, you know, education opportunities, and thinking about what you do with people who are perhaps coming out of prison or coming out of a gang, and, you know, do they have pathways to change their lives. So it's a more holistic approach, essentially. So these things are out there, but it's got to be tailored every time to the context, to the particular city that's concerned.
And are there any significant differences between your work and other researchers in the same field, like, for example, Dennis Rogers?
It depends on what each of us is looking at. What's interestingly similar now about what Dennis is doing and what I've been trying to do is that we've both taken a comparative approach in very different situations. Like, he was looking in the talk that he gave here at Nicaragua and South Africa. I too have been looking at completely different contexts of London, Freetown, Cape Town and Rio, and that we're very similar. But I come from a completely different background. Dennis, you know, has a lot of training in ethnography and has an anthropologist perspective on a lot of this stuff, and worked a lot with criminologists. Whereas I've come from the war studies kind of field. I've been in the past looking at conflict and atrocities, and I've been looking very much at the micro level kind of psychology of this. So where I perhaps am slightly different to others is I'm not just interested in the, what you might call the political economy of violence. You know, why do gangs operate in territory? Why do they accumulate territory based on, you know, the drugs trade? I also want to know on an individual level, what does a person get from joining a gang and from committing violence? Does it give them a sense of excitement, exhilaration, a sense of pride, or a sense of shame? Like, I want to know what individual motivations and push-pull factors are. Is it to do with, you know, their upbringing, their relationship with their parents, all these other complicated things at the individual level, which actually, when you add them together, might actually have an impact on a group level and might relate to these broader structural issues and inequalities. So I'm slightly different, I would say, to Dennis in my disciplinary background and then in my interest on those kind of psychological and emotional dynamics.
And how big is this field, over, like, globally? How many people are doing studies of gangs?
Couldn't possibly tell you. I mean, it's evolving. It's clearly a growing area of interest in some disciplines where it wasn't so much a focus before. Gang studies has been dominated historically by North America. A lot of interest coming out of US cities and, you know, Chicago and LA and New York. But of course, Latin America, South America has its own history, and a lot of research that's grown out of those areas looking at gangs and gangsterism. But you have lots of studies in Asia and Africa, and Europe has its own history, more recent history of studying gangs, which is only really actually, I think, coming to the fore now. And that might be just as much a problem of working in different languages or just the kind of dominance of a Western focus in academia, when actually this research has been there for a long time. But if you think about the traditional disciplines that we're looking at, gangsters and gangs, it's primarily been criminologists, sociologists. Now we see a lot more people focused on conflict and insurgency are looking at what they call criminal insurgencies. They're looking at, you know, Mexico as an example of a supposedly a new kind of insurgency, but a criminal insurgency that is going to increasingly face states. We also see in political science a lot of people who studied civil war and rebel governance now studying criminal conflicts and the governance of non-state actors like traffickers in places around the world. So a lot of those disciplines that were concerned with war are looking towards criminal violence now. And a part of this is to do with urbanization. I mean, in the 21st century, we have passed the point where most people on the planet now actually live in cities. 2008 was the first time we reached that point officially. And the future is urban. The projections for Asia and Africa in particular are that there's going to be massive urban growth, and the mega cities of the world are going to be based in Africa and Southeast Asia. And so a lot of people working in these contexts are increasingly thinking, what does that mean for security studies? What does that mean for development studies? And so you have a convergence of criminologists, development specialists, conflict and peace studies, all converging at this point of looking at the relationship between urban insecurity and urban development. And so gangs are a huge part of that.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the War Studies podcast. For more information about the School of Security Studies, visit kcl.ac.uk/securitystudies.